Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two.
Gilmore.
Oh, big stop.
Oh,
brother.
Lead Toledo artist. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason Mann, and with me as usual is Rich Kraich. Rich, great to be back with you.
Yes, we always have a very good start to this podcast. I always like that. So
yeah.
we're always on the ball. We're ready. You know, we're really undefeated in pretty much all of our podcast openings. So that's how many have we had right now?
Somewhere in the high 70s, I believe.
That's what I think.
So we're close to our 80th episode. So.
That's possible. So we'll just go with that. We're 80-0
in
podcast opening.
Nice.
So I don't know if that's actually true. I think there is quite a few that we've screwed up and had to re-record. But I'm going to go with 80-0 because that's what people have heard. The end result, 80-0.
There you go.
So that was, pretty good win streak to start our podcasting careers, I would say. Not our podcast careers. This podcast.
Sure, so sure.
We're veterans of the game.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So with that, we are talking about some of the best starts in NBA history. I know.
I had no idea. That's cool. Cool.
It's a big surprise. I'm sure you're going to add a lot to the show, Rich, but from that. We took a look at some of the best starts in NBA history. A Basketball Reference, who we always do shout out in the notes, but maybe we don't shout out quite enough on the actual podcast itself, but a wonderful resource that we use a lot. They have a great little tool where they show the NBA's best record after a certain number of games. So it makes it easy to look at it and sort of organize it and to figure out all these teams. So we're going to kind of just go through the best starts in NBA history, talk a little bit about each team and what they did and what was important and or interesting about them. So sound good, Rich?
That sounds good.
All right. So we are going to start off. There are two teams that began the season 14-0, the 1958 Celtics and the 2003 Mavericks. The 1958 Celtics, this was Bill Russell's second year, his first full season. They also had Bob Cousy, Bill Sharman, Tom Heinsohn, and Frank Ramsey, who were their key players. And a player on this team that I had never heard of was Lou Sieropoulos, and which I'm guessing that's how you pronounce it, but he actually died just recently, and he was a more famous as a University of Kentucky player, won a national championship, was on the Celtics only for three seasons. But I just thought that was interesting. Another player who was recently lost from NBA history. Of course, not as significant a part of it as some of the others, but still, you know, it's sort of an interesting guy to know about. But anyway, these Celtics finished 49-23. They were first in the league in SRS, simple rating system, which is a the way Basketball Reference basically measures like a sort of a strength of schedule and differential. It's kind of their way to sort of measure the strength of a team over a season. So and they actually lost. This is one of the years in which Bill Russell did not end up with a championship ring. They lost to the St. Louis Hawks in the 1958 finals.
They did, but luckily they avenged that by winning the next eight. So
yes.
That's pretty good. And then losing one and then losing and winning another two.
Yeah,
so
that worked out pretty
good. I think they made up for it, but I don't know, this Russell guy, I wonder if there was hot takes about Bill Russell not being able to win the big one, even though he won the one, you know, obviously he won the year prior, but, you know, Sure. Geez, like, come on, man, like, let's get it together. And then, yeah.
Yeah. And this was Russell's first full season. This was like his first, you know, being the, he only had played half the season. He was kind of more of a supporting role. He was a little bit more of a, you know, he led the team in minutes this year. He was a little bit more, I mean, obviously he was mostly in the defense and rebounding mode, but I mean, he averaged almost 17 points a game and almost 23 rebounds a game. So that's not too bad, you know?
Yeah, not bad. Yeah, not bad at all. And yeah, of course, you avenged that loss by winning 8 straight is pretty nice.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So, and then the other team to start 14-0, the 2003 Dallas Mavericks. One of you're a big fan of this team. So why don't you talk a little bit?
Yes, one of my favorite teams of all time. It's just a great, great, fun team. I mean, of course, this is the best of the Dirk Nash-Finley era. You know, you have like Ralph LaFrentz in there and Sean Braley and all those sort of guys. And those guys were always kind of supporting cast that were in and out and doing different things. But this of the Dirk Nash-Finley, where you can consider those three, this is arguably their best team. I mean, they made it all the way to the Western Conference Finals. They finished 60-22 after reeling off that opening win. They were first in SRS, as mentioned, you know, by you prior, the simple rating system, which is great. Interestingly enough, they were ninth in defensive rating, which is a big thing of this team. Sort of, you know, there was sort of the thankfully, I think it's kind of over, but especially during the D'Antoni era, where people assume that when you give up a lot of points that you're a bad defensive team, and that doesn't always mean that. I mean, that's why defensive rating is so important, because, well, look, if we score 110 and give up 107, you know, it doesn't matter that we give up 107, because we're always, you know, we're winning by just giving up a little bit more points because we score more. But that wasn't important for this team, is there were some crazy, those early, you know, Dallas Mavericks teams with Don Nelson were just crazy. They were giving up points and doing all that sort of stuff. This is the first year where they really sort of bought in and had a really good defense. A lot of that was zone as well. I remember they played a lot of zone, and it was, I believe, the second year that the NBA allowed zone, and Don Nelson said, fuck it, let's try it and see what happens. And it went with good, because you had Sean Bradley just down in the middle, just kind of there blocking the paint, which worked out real well.
Yeah.
You know, other guys in this team that are pretty, it's a really deep, good team as well. You had Nick Van Exel, you know, in a supporting role, Sean Bradley, Ralph LaFrentz, Adrian Griffin, Rajah Bell, Eduardo Nájera in there. So it was an interesting mix of either really great or very good to great defensive players as well. So it was just a perfect blend of this era of Dallas Mavericks.
Yeah. To me, what's interesting is like, it's it either had guys who were good on one side of the ball or the other side of the ball, but not really, maybe other than Finley, guys who were good on both sides of the ball. So
yeah, because you have Nash and Dirk, who at that point, I mean, Dirk of course got much better at defense, but was a pretty big liability at this point. Nash, who was no real good at all. Nick Van Exel, not a great defender. Sean Bradley became a pretty good defender at this point. Ralph LaFrentz was pretty much a defender at this point. And then like guys like Eduardo Nájera were just, you know, zeros on offense, but great at defense. So yeah, it wasn't nice. This was really just a perfect Mavericks roster until, you know, of course, the their NBA Finals berth, and then of course their NBA championship fears down the line. And then, you know, it'd be the next year, I think, where they would get Antoine Walker and Anton Jameson and all that stuff. And it just, it fell apart after that. But
yeah, they had the year they finished ninth in defense, as you mentioned this year, the was sandwiched in between years in which they finished 25th and 26th in defense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it stands out that this was just a different team that had a better focus on defense, whereas the other years just didn't at all. So interestingly enough, they led the league in scoring that year, 103 points per game. And they committed an NBA record low 11.6 turnovers per game, which is just incredible considering the pace and the amount of points they were able to score and then not turn the ball over. I mean, that's just it's almost unprecedented to have that good of both of those. And they had the best scoring margin in the NBA that year as well. They won games by an average of 7.8 points per game as well. So they're a fairly dominant team as well. And they were just a really, really good team. And in the Western Conference, it looked like there was a real possibility that even though they weren't, you know, this stout defensive team, they weren't, you know, the Spurs or whatever, they had a real good chance of maybe making the NBA Finals. And then they met the Spurs in the Western Conference Finals, and it didn't work out too well. But they got to the Western Conference Finals. So that's pretty fun. But yeah, no, the Spurs took him down, but that's okay.
Yeah, it was in six games. It was a reasonably tight series. It doesn't seem like.
Yeah, and that's.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why those next years of Dallas were just so frustrating, too, because then you had, you know, of course, that they'd shake up the entire roster, get Jameson and Walker in there. That doesn't work. Then Nashley, you know, there was just so many things that kind of piled up. And it's when Dirk started getting his, you know, this was the year where he really built his reputation as, oh, my God, this guy's arrived and he's a really good player. And people started taking note. I think he's only 24 at this point as well. So it's amazing that he was able to just be as good as he was. If you look at his numbers, they're incredible for what he was able to do at 24. But then you sort of started to have him, you know, the Mavericks not doing all that successful, and then it was like, okay, is this guy the guy to lead a team or whatever? And of course, we've seen many years later that was those narratives were really bad and dumb and wrong. So that, this is always a fun little Mavericks team. People forget that this team was so good, and especially so good early. So
yeah. And then we have two teams that finished 15-0. The first is the Washington Capitals of the BAA in the 1949 season. They were coached by, I'm not sure if you've heard of him, Red Auerbach.
That's a silly name, Red.
Yeah. Why would you,
what's that name?
Why would you name a coach Red?
Yeah, exactly.
That's,
what the hell?
That's ridiculous. So the Capitals were a pretty powerful team in the old BAA in the late 40s. They had finished 49-11 in the 47 season, the inaugural season, but then they lost in the playoffs. They also won 17 straight that year, which was to set the record. It was later matched by the Celtics in the 50s. But they did not finish particularly well. They started 15-0 and then they ended 38-22. So they were, I guess, 23-22 for the rest of the season. They were fourth of 12 teams in the league in SRS. They ended up making the BAA finals, but they lost to the Lakers, who had just jumped over that season from the other league, the NBL. And then the NBL and the BAA would merge into the NBA the next season. So their star player was Bob Feerick, who was a three-time All-BAA player, finished second 1 year in points per game. So was a stout scorer, only ended up playing 4 years in the league. But he was one of 25 finalists for the 25th anniversary team and was only one of two of those players who are not in the Hall of Fame, which is interesting. But he also was later a general manager for the Warriors in the 60s. I believe he drafted Rick Barry, and it was kind of an architect for some pretty decent teams there. So
he missed I'm doing a little bit of research on the Capitals, of course, for this, and I'm working on a post for a Heart of Roxism as well. And he played the first game of the playoffs and then missed the rest. I couldn't find exactly what the issue was. I mean, I saw injury, but then nobody ever really clarified what it was. But that was a big loss for them because, of course, he was their big guy. But yeah, he missed a lot of the playoffs. I mean, most all but one game. So that really really kind of hurt their chances, come playoff time.
Yeah. So their other players were the top known players were Bones McKinney and Fat Freddy Scolari.
There's just not enough fat, and Bones. There's just not any Bones. Who's named Bones these days?
Well, there's Brent Berry, of course. But
yeah, but that
he's not really Bones Berry. He's Brent Berry.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody calls him Bones Berry. Right. Like, yeah, exactly. He might call himself that if he wants. So. But nobody. I want people to just that's that guy's name. Like Russell Westbrook should just be Bones Westbrook, right? Like
I mean, theoretically, yes.
Or fat Russell Westbrook. Who would be the fat? I'm trying to think. Is there any guy with an F that fits the?
None that spring to mind. I'm sure there are have to be some, but
fat Frank Kaminsky, like Frank Kaminsky's got a great eye. Yeah. He needs to get fat because unfortunately he's like real skinny.
Yeah,
but
that doesn't
like that's a perfect like 1950s. Maybe athlete. Like Frank Kaminsky. Yeah. Like that's
maybe we're trying to be ironic. Like we try to call maybe when we like call like a a short guy tiny or something.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh yeah. Right.
Yeah.
That's been done in the past. So that's maybe we'll just call him Fat Fred, Fat Frankie Kaminsky.
Yeah.
I think that's so we got it. Okay, cool.
Perfect.
Well, I'm updating his basketball reference page right now. I'm sponsoring it, and then I'm updating
okay,
it.
Okay. So. That,
Wikipedia as well. So you got the rest of this podcast. I'm busy.
All right.
So.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Thank you.
So, yeah, that's all I basically have for the Caps. They ended up folding in – this was kind of the last end of the ride for them. They folded in the 51 season after 35 games. So not a good situation for them or for the early NBA. They eventually consolidated into eight franchises from something like in the high teens, 19 or 18. But of course, things ended up working out in the end for the old NBA. So
I did. Yeah, I did quite well, I believe.
Yes. So. Yes. So next we have the 1994 Houston Rockets. And to me, they're kind of an interesting team. They also began 15-0, as we said, finished 58-24, only sixth in the league in SRS. It was their first year of winning the NBA Finals. They would win back-to-back. Even the next year, they would even be less impressive during the regular season. And to me, like, it's kind of hard looking at the roster of this team and seeing how they won. Of course, they had Hakeem Olajuwon, you know, great superstar in the prime of his career, one of, you know, top five player in the league, maybe the best player in the league now that Jordan was out of the league. And then their only other above average production wise player was Otis Thorpe. And then everyone else, you know, they had, you know, they had like Vernon Maxwell, Robert Horry, Kenny Smith, and Mario Elie as kind of their other key players. But, you know, and, you know, they're obviously like, you know, good role players, smart guys, you know, some good shooters. But none of them, you know, at least production wise was really, you know, particularly impressive. They definitely seemed like a team that was more than the sum of its parts. Definitely a team that, you know, relied on chemistry or intangibles or, you know, whatever you want to say, rather than, you know, how they produced. Because yeah, I've been doing some, looking at kind of like some of the best non-Bulls teams in the 90s, just some research for, you know, maybe something I'm going to write or maybe something we'll do a podcast on. And and Houston by far is less impressive than several of the Western Conference teams that did not win, that never won a championship.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird.
Yeah, it is very. I mean, they do stick out. They're kind of like the oddity team of this era. And, they, you know, of course, everybody sort of, you know, Michael Jordan leaves and then, you know, a random team wins or whatever. And it really is just kind of a random. I mean, you really look at it and you look at the differences between their roster and, you know, what attested for them to just be, because it's not only just, you know, winning the NBA Finals, it's getting to the NBA Finals as well. And for them to leapfrog a lot of these teams, it's just interesting. It's weird. It doesn't, there's just, I don't know what the secret recipe was. It didn't seem like Hakeem had, I mean, he had a very, very good year or whatever, but it's not like this guy just was like figured out something in his game and got really good this year or whatever, you know. And then other guys, like you mentioned, like a Robert Horry was, you know, in his, you know, second year, I believe at that point, guys like Mario Elie were in their third years or whatever. There weren't really like, I don't know. Was it like Otis Thorpe figuring it out or whatever? Like not really. I don't know. Yeah, it's a very interesting team. I just don't quite get it. But like you said, it might just be like the perfect storm of guys coming together and doing something and really working. But yeah, it's a very odd year. They definitely stick out. And you wonder if they would just be a team that, you know, if they reach the finals, you know, like the Suns did or whatever, would they just get, you know, destroyed, or they would lose to the Bulls, and then that would be the end of, you know, the Rockets being that one Western Conference team that came in. But, you know, the fact that they were able to get to the NBA Finals and beat the Knicks, you know, they stand out. But then they were able to do it the next year as well. I mean, of course, you know, next year they added a few different parts, you know, Clyde Drexler, obviously, you know, a big one. But yeah, this is a very odd team. It's just, you don't, on paper, it just doesn't seem like, yeah, that team won the NBA Finals. If I showed you this team and told you the year they played and didn't tell you who won the championship that year, I don't think you would assume that these guys won.
Yes. And they also had Scott Brooks, later Oklahoma City coach.
Yes.
Sam Cassell. And
who I was reading an SI Vault piece. I forgot who the author was, but they said Scott Brooks looks like Michael J. Fox with a dyed hair.
Yes.
And they questioned, have you ever seen them together? And I went, you know, I haven't. So, no. You know.
Yeah. I don't think of them as looking that much alike as, you know, like as the, you know, older version of Scott Brooks. But you have to go back and look at Scott Brooks as a player.
He was pretty dreamy. He was pretty dreamy.
Yeah, yeah, I recall him being handsome. I just don't remember like him and Michael J. Fox looking so much alike. But there you go. And then
I think a wafty hair white guy
there you go.
Credentials for looking like Michael J. Fox at that point.
Yeah, maybe we're just stretching that a little bit. Matt Bullard, also longtime Rocket, was on the team. And then I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but Ohio State's Chris Gents, who was kind of their hustle avatar, like their Dellavedova.
Rookie year for Chris as well, right?
Was that? Yeah,
this was a rookie year. Rookie year.
I mean, he barely played in the league, and he played like 70 minutes or so on the 78 minutes in three games. But he I was a big Ohio State basketball fan in the early 90s. Jim Jackson was my, you know, favorite player ever.
Yeah.
I watched a lot of their games growing up in Columbus. And so I was excited for the Rockets when they won this championship because, you know, Chris Gent was, you know, somehow involved in a small way. So very, very, very small way. And he was also later LeBron's shooting coach. So good for Chris.
Oh, right. Yeah. I forget that. Yeah.
So and was an assistant coach in the NBA, you know, other stops as well. So he's kind of been around. I'm not sure exactly what he's doing right now. But yeah, you mentioned that SI Vault piece. And it was interesting because it was, yeah, this was during the time in which the Rockets had, you know, were having their winning streak. And it mentioned, interestingly, that Tomjanovich, there was an early season Rockets Knicks game in which the Rockets, I think that was like the last win of their streak before they lost to Atlanta to finish it out. But you know, Rudy T even says, if we have to come back here in June for the NBA Finals and people say we can't win in New York, hey, we've done it, which of course predicts the, you know, the Rockets, Knicks Finals, which was not really necessarily like, I mean, they were, you know, among the contenders, but it wasn't like, oh yeah, that's obvious, kind of thing. And it was interesting also the talks about how they began, early in the 92-93 season, they began with a 7-game losing streak. And then since the end of that streak, they've gone 57-12, had 2 15-game winning streaks and another 10-game winning streak. So, and basically they just talked about like how they just got more serious about defense. They kind of figured out a scheme that worked really well for Olajuwon, but also everyone else. Had good coverage. They had good outside shooting. They had good, you know, Robert Horry and Sam Cassell, who were second year and rookie players respectively, you know, contributed well, and they just had good reserves. And, you know, their roster wasn't that different, but they just were able to kind of change their style of play and it all kind of fit together. So,
yeah, it's a really good article. Rudy also talks about how that probably helped him. You know, losing that many games was like, all right, people, look, like, you try to do it your way and it sucks, so now you're doing it my way. Right. Like, sort of thing like that. We're not like he's being an authoritarian like that, but just basically being like, okay, hey, look, here's a wake-up call. Like, let's do this now. Let's focus on this and let's try to change it, because whatever we're doing right now, you know, just isn't working. And it worked, you know, great. And, you know, they went off with 2 NBA championships. So go them.
There you go them. So next we have at 19-1, the 1991 Portland Trail Blazers. They, finished 63-19. They were second in SRS, to the Bulls that year. They ended up losing to the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals. However, even though this was of the three teams, they made the finals in 90 and 92, but this was the strongest regular season team of the three by far. They had similar rosters in those years: Clyde Drexler, Terry Porter, Jerome Kersey, who we did a show on when he passed away last year, Buck Williams. They also had key contributions from Kevin Duckworth, Clifford Robinson, and newcomer Danny Ainge, who they'd gotten from in the offseason from Sacramento. They also had, at the very end of his career, Walter Davis, and they had 133 minutes of Drazen Petrovic, who was
the famous, hey, can you play me? I'm good. And I don't know who you are, so no.
Yeah.
Drazen Petrovic. And then, hey, can I go to the Nets and be good? Yeah, okay.
There you go. And it worked out pretty well for him. You know, they kind of said he wasn't ready. He demanded a trade early in the season. Then he was kind of like a mascot on the team. Basically, he was like cheered like crazy from the crowd. He was like a Portland like cult favorite.
No, like the Brian Scalabrine of your team.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
But good. But actually good.
Yeah. Funny, given what he turned out to be, a very good player before his untimely death. But, and yeah, there was an SI piece to kind of talking about what made them work is basically like looking at sort of their versatility, especially in defense with Kersey and Williams and Robinson able to, you know, both positions in the front court. Drexler able to move to small forward, even Ainge being, you know, between both guard positions. And something I didn't know was that the Blazers that things had gone badly between Drexler and their previous coach, Mike Shuler. They basically feuded and Shuler was fired, and then Adelman took over midway through the 89 season. So, and obviously Portland immediately became really, really good. So that obviously was a good decision on their part, but I hadn't kind of realized, like, I honestly know very little about the pre-1990 Trailblazers pre-1990, so yeah. So that'll warrant a look back at some point, but I think Portland's kind of weirdly just, you know, because they're, even though they made 2 finals, they're sort of these, I feel like these teams are not remembered that well, and they were really good. I mean, you know, they
really deep. I mean, yeah. That's the thing that I remember where, you know, we talked about Houston and we're like, how does this team make the finals? Like, this team you read and you're like, oh my God, this is a powerhouse. Right. Like, they're you know, to the point where you don't play Drazen Petrovic. Like there's just no need to even get him on the floor or whatever. And of course, you know, I don't think anybody predicted he was going to average 22 a game or whatever, but the fact that he just couldn't get on the floor from this team speaks volumes, not of where he was at that point, but where they were, where it's like, look, we can't really, like, we have so many other good guys. Sorry. Like, it's just a super deep team. I mean, Danny Ainge is there and just is a guy who, it's just up and down that lineup is just so good. It's incredible.
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of a shame that this was the team that lost to the Lakers, though, that gave Magic one more run in the finals and gave us obviously a Lakers Bulls series, which was really one of the few times where you kind of get that like cool passing of the torch thing between, you know, one era's team versus another era's team. But they might have given the Bulls a more competitive finals that year. Although the 92 finals was a pretty good finals. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So next, your favorite team, the 23-1 1970 New York Knicks. They finished 60-22. They were first in the league in SRS. They famously won the NBA Finals that year. They had a they had an 18 game winning streak during this time. Of course, lots of books and documentaries recounting the exploits of this team. The names are very familiar: Willis Reed, Walt Frazier, Dick Barnett, Dave DeBuscher, Bill Bradley. They also had Mike Reardon, Cassie Russell, and Dave Stallworth as the other key guys on the team who are less known. I guess Cassie Russell's pretty well known, but the other guys, I don't think as much. Red Holzman, of course, being the coach. There's not really that much more to add. You know, this is a pretty famous team. There's
read many books. Yeah, read books that do a much better job. There's like five of them, so you can.
We've done podcasts on talking about this team in different levels of
detail. Yeah.
So our Game 7 Finals podcast, I think we did a pretty good job going through. There was one kind of good thing on an SI Vault piece on them is talking about how the 18th game of that winning streak, they were behind 105-102 Cincinnati with 16 seconds to go. Willis Reed hit a pair of free throws. Then DeBuscher stole an inbounds pass at midcourt, went in for a layup. And then finally Reed tipped another pass toward Frazier, who was fouled while shooting. And then with 2 seconds left, sank both free throws to win 106-105. So
that's a fun 16 seconds, yeah, man.
Pretty impressive.
Not a good day to be a Cincinnati Royals.
No. And they were about to lose their team. So that wasn't much.
Better, yeah, either. That's even worse.
Yeah.
Then you know what? That was such a bad loss. We are taking your team away. Yes. You can no longer have a team. Bye.
Yes. So,
and you'll never have a team ever again. Bye.
No. So shall we move on?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, so I guess we can kind of group these two teams together because they're
so similar. Yes. Yeah,
the Boston Celtics of 2008 and 2009 seasons. The 2009 season peaked at 26-2, that they finished 62-20. They were second in the league in SRS. They lost in the conference semifinals, mostly because of KG suffered an injury later in the season, missed the playoffs and missed the ability to be able to do that. But they, they were a great team, definitely on their way to a possible championship. The year they did win the championship in 2008, they started 29-3. They finished 66-16. They were first in SRS, won the NBA title, though they had some odd struggles in the playoffs. Of course, this is the Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, Paul Pierce, Big Three. 2008 was the first year of that team. They also had Rajon Rondo, Kendrick Perkins, Eddie House playing some big roles, Glenn Davis, Leon Poe, Tony Allen, particularly on the second year of that team, plus the 414 minutes of Stephon Marbury in 2009, yes, which we all remember. In 2008, they had the all-time great turnaround, improving their record by 42 wins, which is pretty good.
Not bad. It's good reversal of fortune. So, yes.
So let's see. I don't know, anything else that stands out about those teams to you?
Not really. I mean, the first one, the 2019 that we mentioned, the one that lost in the semifinals, they seemed to sort of lose some steam about midway through the year. And you can understand that as well with all that happened in that 2008 season and running through the finals and just a fantastic record, 66-16. And then you start the next season and you go 26-2 and everything's looking good. But yeah, they seem to tire a little bit down that stretch. I mean, they lost 7 of 10 from a Christmas Day game until early January. Right. And then, the first round of the playoffs, they struggled with the Bulls. Famously, that's the, you hear you see the highlights of Joe Kim Noah running the floor and dunking on guys like that. That was a Bulls team that probably was Derrick Rose's rookie year, I believe, that really had just no business competing with the Celtics on any level. And we're neck and neck with them the entire time. And luckily they got out of that. And then it just became so much for them. And it's testament that they did still get to the semifinals. But you saw that team was just it was getting tired and it just couldn't keep up with that sort of pace. And, they'd have a nice little kind of mini dynasty for the next few years. But that was, by and large, the end of their true what I would call dominance or whatever. They were a dominant team until probably midway through this year and then sort of cracks started to form. You know, KG gets hurt and all that sort of stuff. But for the most part, I mean, still a really remarkable 2-year stretch. As far as that second year, there was a really – or the first year, rather, 2008, when they won the NBA Finals, was really good SI piece as well. And one of the quotes from it was, Boston's 17th championship was earned by three players who supposedly couldn't win the big one, a coach who supposedly couldn't draw an X and O on a tic-tac-toe board, and a general manager who supposedly couldn't pick a winner out of a police lineup. So yes. – Which I always remember from that team as well. Like, it, you know, not being, I'm obviously not a huge Celtics fan, but that's something I enjoyed is like, okay, Doc Rivers can't coach. You know, everybody sort of assumed that Danny Ainge was being just lauded as, you know, a nothing GM at that point, you know, because he made a lot of really bad mistakes, you know, in the years prior. And then these three guys, you know, like a Ray Allen couldn't do it with the Bucks, and, you know, he's not a leader. And Kevin Garnett, you know, got really close with the Timberwolves, but just wasn't enough to do it. But it was really fun to see those all come together. And Paul Pierce, of course, with the Celtics was like, yeah, he can shoot a lot, but who cares, you know, and it was fun in 1 year for just so many narratives just be destroyed and blown up, which I always like that. I like whenever terrible sports narratives get blown up is makes me a happy person. So
sure. And the 08 team also had James Posey plus Sam Cassell and P.J. Brown in small regular season roles, but they played fairly big playoff roles, especially P.J.
Brown. Yeah, P.J. Brown had like one – didn't he have like a 15-point, like 20-rebound game or some like ridiculous number? There's like one – I forget. I don't have it in front of me, but there's only one insane P.J. Brown like playoff game. Yeah. Where you're just like, what?
I remember him hitting some big shots. I don't remember specifically a huge P.J. Brown game. He wore 93 in Boston, which is a good number. It's but yeah, he definitely you know, wasn't he a buyout guy too? I kind of forgot about
yeah, was he on the Bulls?
Yeah, I believe so.
He was on the Bulls before that. I don't remember if that's he had another stop in between there. Let me no, he was okay, he was bought off from the Bulls and then went there. Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah,
that was the last year. Oh
yeah, right,
good end for PJ.
Good
Brown.
Way to go. Yeah,
I always liked PJ.
I always liked him too. Yeah.
Yeah. Hit a nice little elbow jumper or two a game for you. That's all you
yeah,
need.
Yeah, I enjoyed him in I enjoyed him in Miami. I always thought he was he was very good in Miami. I was trying to look and see if there was he had he didn't really have any big. He had a 10-6 game. I don't think in Boston he didn't have necessarily a standout playoff game production wise, but he did play well. I mean, he just, you know, good defense and timely shots and all that good stuff. But production wise, it does not appear that he had a big game during that series. So you must be remembering something else P.J. Brown did, or
some other P.J. Brown somebody else. Though, so.
Yeah, one of the memory P.J. Brown memories that we all have.
Right.
So next we have. We have three teams that reached the record of 37-3, which is not bad. Yeah. First is the 1967 Philadelphia 76ers. They were 68-13, which was the best ever record up until that point. First in SRS by a mile. One of the great – well, all three of these teams are among the greatest SRS teams of all time. They're all in the top five or so. This, by the way, was the last 81-game season. The previous year was 80 games. The next year would be 82 games, and that would, of course, continue until today. They were led by Wilt Chamberlain, Hal Greer, and Chet Walker. Also had Billy Cunningham, Luke Jackson, and Wally Jones as their key players. They were coached by Alex Hannum, who also led the 58 Hawks to the title, so was the only, you know, coach during this period other than the Celtics, Auerbach, and then Russell's a player coach who won NBA championships. The most interesting thing about the SI Vault article kind of talking about them is more of a feature on Alex Hannum and talking about how the 76ers were not embraced initially by a skeptical Philadelphia public. The problem was that the Warriors had gone to San Francisco and had taken kind of all the real Philadelphia players with them, the Wilt and Guy Rogers and guys who had also like Tom Gola and Paul Arizin who were no longer around. Even owner Eddie Gottlieb, who was a very influential Philadelphia guy who had lost. But you know, eventually they brought back Chamberlain, Wally Jones was Philadelphia, Matt Gukas was Philadelphia, and Jack Ramsey, they were all kind of had those Philadelphia connections, so it helped the city embrace the team, which is just kind of funny. Like, no one really necessarily cares that much about whether the local team has a local guy. I mean, there's some benefit.
In the day, though, back in then, I definitely, especially if, you know, the NBA was built a lot on that. Like, you know, guys from their areas or respective areas, you know, the draft was, and baseball was that way as well for a long time, where it was like a big deal. Now people just don't really care. But it's probably just because, you know, before, you know, nowadays you pick a guy from whatever college across the world, you've seen that guy play, you know, 10,000 times and you see his highlights all the time. But I get it how, you know, if you were a random fan, you're like, hey, we drafted this guy. You're like, I never heard of him. Like, who cares about this guy? Like,
I want Tom Holloback. Like,
exactly. Yeah. Like, no, I'm not going to go to the game because I don't know who these guys are or whatever. Like, I get that. But yeah, no, it's probably better now that we don't do
that.
But
I mean,
it's still, you see it from time to time. You know, like a Derrick Rose in Chicago is still an important, you know, figure for that team or whatever. But the team doesn't like live and die. Like, if they don't get a guy from Chicago, the Bulls aren't going to, you know, go bankrupt. Like, it's fine. Yeah. Like, it really doesn't matter.
It's a nice bonus now. And there's certain times where the synergy, obviously with LeBron and Cleveland, where it works very well. But it's not like what it used to be for sure. So. And then also we have the 72 Los Angeles Lakers, who won 33 games in a row, finished 69-13, first in SRS. Elgin Baylor retired early in the season, so they were led by Wilt Chamberlain, Jerry West, Gail Goodrich. They also had solid journeymen like Happy Hairston, Flynn Robinson, and Jim McMillian. Also, Pat Riley was a reserve on the team. This was the year that first-year coach Bill Sharman famously instituted morning shoot-arounds, which was a little bit tricky for Wilt.
In L.A.
Well, even more for Wilt, being a guy who was a bit of an insomniac and liked to sleep in the mornings.
He was busy at night, so that's probably I'm sure it wasn't. I'm sure it wasn't from lack of trying. I think it was.
He was doing stuff. That's true. What kind of stuff? Who knows? But the interesting thing,
puzzles.
Yeah, the interesting thing for me about these two teams, the 76, the Sixers and the Lakers, is that both of those teams had like five or six guys who like dominated the minutes, like who were like. With the Lakers, they had their top five guys all had like 27,000 or more minutes. And then like their sixth and seventh guys had 1,000 minutes. You know, it was like just like a hugely wide distribution. And the Sixers were kind of the same way. Billy Cunningham had like, you know, they had like six guys with over 2,000 minutes. Will had 3,600 minutes. So, and then like they just were very like five or six deep teams and then not much else beyond that, which I just thought was kind of interesting. I'm sure expansion part of that, and maybe just, you know, you might look at minutes distribution on a lot of teams, and maybe that was more of a thing that was in vogue then, but I just thought kind of that stood out to me.
Yeah, maybe that's what you need, and maybe, you know, in those days, or at least maybe even today, is like a team where you just play your best guys and just drive them to the ground for a little while to get this. Whereas, you know, nowadays, I think it's more than ever, guys sort of, or teams rather, understand that, you know what, hey, look, you know, we're this guy needs a day off, or that guy needs a day off. I mean, pretty much like the San Antonio Spurs model, where it's like, yeah, I mean, it'd be nice to win, like, you know, 65 games in the regular season, but is it really that big of a deal if we win the NBA championship? Who's going to care? So it is less of that, and I don't know if you're ever going to see that again, but yeah, that's an interesting thing that maybe it is. Maybe that's one of the recipes to becoming as good of a team, or having as good of a start, is just that you have your guys, you have your really, really good players, and you play them to death and just go with them.
Yes. It's also worth noting that the 67-76ers actually did reach 47-5. So they which, you know, the 37-3 is great, but 47-5 is pretty impressive as well. And also reaching both those milestones, in fact, even slightly better in the case of the second team, is in is the Chicago Bulls of 1996. Pretty famous team led by Michael Jordan, who you may have heard of.
Tony Kukoc. Oh, Bill Weddington.
Yes.
I thought who you were going to say. Led by the stalwart center. Bill Wellington, yes. Yeah, who did a
they were 72-10. They were first in SRS. They had the most wins ever, although not number one all time in SRS. The 71 Bucks actually take that.
Yeah, take that, Michael.
Yeah, there you go.
Don't tell Michael he'd get really pissed. He'd he'd find some way to compete in this. He'd probably change. He'd like get so mad. He'd run to the offices and tell them to change the algorithm or something.
I think so. Kareem called him a sellout recently. So I think maybe he really inferred that. I haven't actually read the quote yet, so
that's great.
This will be a week old by the time people hear this, but anyway, yeah. So maybe he has other reasons to be mad at Kareem is my point. So you, as a Bulls fan, why don't you take it away a little bit on?
Yeah, of course, just a historic team. I mean, a lot of people know, you know, many of the different facts and fun stuff from it. I mean, for most of the people listening to this, you probably grew up in an era where this was kind of a team you grew up on. You know, you're the really young basketball fan, maybe a little bit older, but either way, you have most likely vivid memories of this Bulls team. And this was the epicenter, the big, you know, peak of NBA fandom across the world as well, and across you know America, of course, where it was just gigantic at this time. They won, you know, 37 straight games at home. Just an insane overall record at home as well. They only lost two times at home. They had a 12.3 margin of victory. So remember we talked about the Mavericks, the 2002 Mavericks team, or the 2003 Mavericks team rather. And they had, you know, 7.8, you know, was their margin of victory. This team is 12.3, which is just insane ever. So that was tied for the best ever. They were the first in the league in both offensive rating and defensive rating. This was, you know, a mark that the Warriors did last year as well. And it really just the true mark of a team that is just unstoppable and just destined to win. It's just like, you know, not a fluke team at all, just a team that's just so good. And one of the more interesting facts I think of this entire team is they have one losing streak all year, two games. They lost two in a row, probably a very stressful time for the Bulls locker room. But yeah, only one losing streak all year, and it was only two games, which is just insane. Of course, the makeup of the team: Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman, who we'll talk about here in a little bit, Steve Kerr, Ron Harper, Luke Longley, Bill Weddington. It was really the Jordan, Pippen, Rodman, Kerr, Harper were that. I mean, again, we talk about that solid five. Those were your solid five there. The role players were solid in there, but it was really those guys that led a lot of it. Or I should have Longley in there. Longley was the center on that team, but Kerr was a very good piece off the bench, just a great shooter of his era. An interesting note as well, a few of the oddities of this team, and that's one of the best parts of these like Bulls teams, and is looking at the guys at like the end of the roster who like grabbed extra rings or whatever. Like we'll talk the next year was Robert Parrish grabbing a ring. This team had two bad boys, James Blue Edwards and John Saley, earned additional rings here. And also Dennis Rodman, of course, was a member of the Bad Boys teams as well, and he got a ring here. And it's kind of fitting those two guys got the rings as well with this team. And then Rodman was really just a guy who propelled this team to next level. The year prior, of course, that was Michael Jordan's comeback year. They lost to the Magic in the Eastern Conference Finals, and Jordan spent an offseason just kind of stewing about that and came back just determined and made sure that everybody else was determined, made sure that Ron Harper was in better shape, made sure that everybody was ready to go and just win the title was their biggest, you know, priority. But about halfway through the year, they realized, oh shit, we've only lost like twice or three times or whatever. So let's see what we can do here. And then just really just a team that just never took a day off and just really did everything they could to win, you know, 70 games. And of course, 72, which is a mark that I just don't think anybody will ever eclipse. So what do you think? Do you think I just don't know if any team's going to be that manic about doing it. I think they're going to want to reserve their guys, or guys are going to take days off, or I just don't know. I just don't think that any team is going to want to win every single regular season game like this team did.
Yeah, I don't see it happening either. I mean, it's certainly possible. I guess it's theoretically possible, but it just seems like it's such a hard, I mean, you're right. It just doesn't seem like anyone is going to approach the regular season like that. Although the Warriors this year, I don't, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they're on a war path right now.
Yeah.
So.
So
it might take something like that, where a team either circumstances of like numerous expansion teams or something like that, which of course was an issue with this year, is that you have the Raptors and the Grizzlies in there, yeah. So it changed a little bit the power. Maybe it would be something like that, but I don't see the NBA really like being like, hey, we're adding like three new teams this year, like two new teams or whatever. I just don't see that happening. And then also, yeah, it would take like a team really feeling slighted and going, okay, we're just going to dominate everybody. You know, and the Warriors can talk all they want about their, you know, oh, we're overrated or we got lucky thing. But at a certain point, I think, you know, Luke Walton and Steve Kerr, you know, when he eventually takes back the coaching reins, and Curry and all those sort of guys will at some point just realize, hey, whatever, let's just win the NBA Finals. Who cares? Like, but who knows? They're on a nice little path right now. Yeah. So,
A couple things. Yeah, 96, as you mentioned, expansion year. 67 was also an expansion year where it went from 9 to 10 teams. 72 was not an expansion year, but it was only a year or two after the league had gone from 14 to 17 teams. And if I'm not mistaken, I think we have just gone through, we're now under the longest period of time in NBA history without any expansion.
Well, the Bobcats were what, 03?
I believe, yeah.
03 or 04, I don't remember which one.
I think 04 was their first season. So, okay. So yeah, I mean, that's 11 years. I don't believe we've had an 11-year stretch without without expansion. I guess there was a lot of contraction up until 54, and then there was expansion, I think, in 62. So, so yeah, I guess if you consider the merger of the league in 1952, 62, I guess we're like a year off of that. But other than that, I don't think we've had a period of time in which we've gone, you know, this amount of time without any expansion. So that's sort of interesting.
Yeah, it is. What do you think? Do you think that's they're going to add teams anytime soon? I don't know. I kind of have a weird feeling about it. I don't know.
It kind of feels like they would maybe try to add a Seattle team at some point. Just Seattle is such good leverage for anyone who wants to move to get more money for their arena or whatever that they don't want to do that, which sucks, but it's just sort of the way that that it happens. But yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely like possible, but I don't know if like the NBA, like if there's like a compelling reason to do it. I mean, I guess if they want,
I see more teams moving. I see more movement than straight up expansion. Like, you know, maybe a team, but even then, like most of the teams that we sort of considered moving have pretty much sewn up arena deals, at least in the past few years. You know, a team like Milwaukee, Sacramento is one as well, where you sort of assume, hey, maybe they're going to go. But yeah, it seems, yeah, it's more than ever.
Anybody in danger moving right now.
Stable. Yeah, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, anymore. There was always those two, but now I don't know who really it is. I mean, yeah, everyone's pretty solid right now. I'm trying to think off the top of my head of any team that seems like they're really struggling, but it's a healthy league right now.
Yeah, all that TV money, that'll help. Yeah,
yeah, and even like a team like Atlanta, where you sort of look at it and go, ah, nobody. But now they're, you know, a hot commodity and stuff. So yeah, there's really not anybody, which is cool.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah,
a few other things about this team. Of course, I mentioned Dennis Rodman coming to the team being a big part of why they sort of had their big turnaround. Of course, he came very, very early in the team, just five days before their training camp was going to open. He joined the team and they had to get the blessing of Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan because it is Dennis Rodman. And at this time, of course, you know, Dennis Rodman is Dennis Rodman. And famously, because Dennis Rodman is that, I mean, the Bulls had so many issues with, you know, the bad boys, Rodman in particular, and Pippen. As a guy who still has a scar underneath his chin from a time when Rodman shoved him into the crowd. And there's a quote in this SI piece where he says, "I don't have to like Rodman off the basketball court as long as I like what he does on the court." And that was his quote when the training camp started. So, yeah, that's the Dennis Rodman thing. But, hey, even if you don't like each other, and, you know, famously this year, I think Michael Jordan punched out Steve Kerr during a practice. But, hey, if it wins, who cares, right? That's what it is. But yeah, it was just a different stuff. And Steve Kerr had a quote. This is the Bulls had a really good thing, because I think the anniversary, of course, was a few years ago. And if you look at history.bulls.com/72-10, if you run a really good, like, kind of long form piece about this team. And Steve Kerr had a really good quote here. He says, "There was an incredible motivation and everything clicked. As motivated as Michael always was, that year was another few degrees higher based on what he had been through. The absence from the game, the loss the previous year to Orlando, the motivation was just incredible. It carried on the entire season, and that's what made it so incredible, or so remarkable, rather. It's just that, yeah, this team just wouldn't give up. And Jordan basically was just determined to win and you know, win this title and prove himself as a player again. But interestingly enough, we're going to go on to the next year. They go 49-6, this 1997 Bulls team, very nearly got to 70 wins, which is just insane, because no team in history before that had gotten to 70 wins. And this team was, you know, one game away from doing it to back-to-back years. It was just an incredible level of that team. A lot of interesting quotes again. You don't really have to go through a bunch of the stuff of this team. It was, you know, once again, they were first in the league in offensive rating. They unfortunately fell all the way to fourth in defensive rating. So, you know, that's what killed them there in that 70 wins. But more than that, it was just an incredible team. I mean, similar to 1996, Weddington played a little bit less. Jason Caffey and Randy Brown played a little bit more. Robert Parrish, as we mentioned, got a ring here. Played a little bit, you know, not as much of just kind of a token role. Actually had a few games here and there where he got in there, but, you know, not a ton of stuff from him. But, you know, interestingly enough, that their final game where they were going to win, get the bid to get the 70 wins was against the Knicks, and they lost it by 3 points. Chicago hung with the Knicks, but Ewing dropped 27. Allen Houston, who was kind of a new Knicks addition, dropped 25, and New York pulled away in the fourth quarter, you know, winning 33-24 in that. So thankfully the Bulls would sort of get the revenge later in the playoffs, beating the Knicks and knocking them out. But a lot of really good SI pieces. Jack McCollum has just an incredible piece about this Bulls team, which is actually funny. I quoted it on Twitter. He mentions that the league, there was just a weirdness around the league that this team was just so dominant and so incredible and so like polarizing, or not polarizing is not the right word because everybody loves them. I'll have some quotes here that talk about it, but just that they became bigger than the league. Like, people were Bulls fans, not NBA fans. And he questions what's going to happen when this Bulls team either falls apart, doesn't do what they do, or Michael Jordan's leaves and says, hey, is the NBA going to go through a giant malaise once Jordan and the Bulls are done or whatever? And David Stern says, no, that won't happen. You know, Oscar Robertson left, Magic left, and we were fine after that. It's been no problem. And David Stern was absolutely right, because the NBA flourished in the post Michael Jordan era, so that's fine. But it was interesting because, I mean, reading Jack McCollum, he's got real things here, and it's interesting because this entire quote, and you can look it up, I think I linked it on our Twitter account as well. There's quotes from different players and stuff like that. The first one I'll talk about here a little bit is Jack McCollum's words. He says, 7 weeks remain in the regular season, but is there any reason that the engravers should not get started on the championship trophy right now? Does anyone envision a scenario other than an injury to Jordan in which the Chicago Bulls, 50-7 at week's end, 7 games better than their nearest competitors, the Detroit Pistons, do not breeze to their second title and their fifth in the decade? And then Doug Collins, who was the coach of the Pistons, the second place team, says, when the Bulls are ready to hang it up, we just want to be ready to take over for them. So Doug Collins, ever the inspirer, says, well, we can't beat them, but maybe if they leave, we'll do well. And just quotes about, I remember this as well, living in Chicago. Maybe I sort of was skewed because it was my hometown team, but just so many people being invested in that team. Jack McCollum talked to numerous fans and players and teams or whatever that felt like the Bulls at that point were almost just like a traveling roadshow. Like, people came to see the Bulls. And Terrell Brandon, who was the Cavaliers guard at this time, said that he was kind of upset. There was a game where I think the Cavaliers beat them, and said that the fans were almost like booing them and like cheering the Bulls. And he says, quote, it's a problem when the home fans cheer for the opposing team. Like, people went there to see the Bulls. They didn't go there to see their hometown Cavs. And like, he was a little upset by that. Dikembe Mutombo added a quote as well. He said, I think some players are just happy to be on the same court with Michael Jordan and the fans to be in the same arena. So it became almost like a bigger than the NBA phenomenon of these two teams in two consecutive years, just being so good, so great, and just all this sort of stuff coming together. It's just it's a remarkable 2-year stretch. Like, it's just, it's unprecedented. Like, it will never, ever, because again, like I said, with the 72 win team, I just don't envision a scenario where a team is going to take the regular season as serious as these guys did.
Yeah. And I wonder if there's a chance we get a similar phenomenon with Golden State. It's a little early to be talking about this. Obviously, it's early into their second season, but last year they were a regular season team with not quite the level of dominance of the 96-97 Bulls, but not that far off, even though they obviously don't have that. They don't have Michael Jordan on their team. I mean, Steph Curry is amazing, but and it is maybe, the greatest offensive weapon in NBA history, certainly from a perimeter player, but he's obviously not quite Jordan. But I do wonder if there's going to be that kind of like that sense of awe from other players, and if they have this kind of larger life feeling that the Bulls had during this time, and whether how that affects if obviously that could upset some people, and that already Golden State's attitudes upset some people. Golden State very much has gotten in a lot of mileage out of perceived slights to them, which I think is kind of been a little bit silly. I don't think anyone's really been that much of a, it has really like thought that they were a fluke or something like that. I think that's kind of all been,
yeah, you're first in offensive rating and defensive rating,
right? I'm sure people have said that, but I don't think anybody has been.
Those people are stupid.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no one seriously believes that, I don't think. So you said it well, and they are obviously an incredible team. So they, the 97 Bulls peaked at 49-6. The 96 Bulls, they reached 54-6, 60-7, 66-8, 71-9, and of course 72-10 as they finish. So good record
with a loss to the expansion Toronto Raptors as well, which is one of my favorite nuggets of that entire team, is that this like all time great team loses to an expansion team. Yeah. Like it's sometimes the NBA, man. It's a fun little game, but
it is indeed. So yeah, that was a good start for us. Good start to a new season for us. So we're kind of planning to do one show a week, at least during the regular season. We'll kind of see what we might do a little bit of a reduced schedule during the playoffs, and then come back strong with another off-season series where we're a little bit more frequent during the off-season when there's not as much going on, obviously. So that seemed to work well for us over this summer. So I think we're going to try to kind of continue going in that vein.
I think so. Yeah, we're willing and motivated. We were slighted last year, so we're going to dominate the regular season this year. I don't know how we were slighted, but we're going to make it up.
I'm sure
somebody on Twitter was mean to us.
I'm sure someone slighted us.
We're going to get really upset about it.
Someone picked another history podcast over us, so we're very upset by that. Yeah,
one of the other many NBA history podcasts that are out there right now.
Indeed, yes. So in all earnest, somebody touted them over us, and we were like, so take that. So. Anyway,
and I punched you to get you motivated, and then we're good.
Yes. So you can find us at hardwoodparoxysm.com. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. Also, we have our forums at overandbacknba.com, where we have lots of discussion about basketball history. And you can find us on iTunes, both Over and Back and the HP Basketball Network of podcasts are both on iTunes. We would love your rating and review to let other people know that we're pretty cool and that you should listen to us. So if you think that, then we would appreciate it if you give us a rating. And until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.